evening.
It's great to have you all here. This is a subject that's very near and dear to my heart. In our family, we started intergenerational family discussions 35 years ago. And we sat around my grandfather's dining room table. And then my grandfather passed away. We sat around my mother's table. She passed away. We now sit around my table. I just got an email a couple of days ago from my nephew who lives in Fairbanks, Alaska, and he's planning to come to the family meeting to discuss mostly what we discuss is philanthropy. What got me thinking about this, and Zach in particular, I had not met Zach before, but I had a good friend who has a multi-generational family business. It goes back probably 80 years. And they got Zach to explain the family business to their granddaughter who is graduating from college. And they called me up to tell me about this lawyer who did a wonderful job, and I needed to meet Zach. And so I got in touch with Zach, and we've gotten in touch with Zach. And as you've probably seen, Bray and Zach have co-authored some articles together. So I'm going to let Bray do the rest of it. I think everybody here knows Bray. I hope you all know that he is a partner now in the firm that's been in place for a year.
Thanks, sir. Thank you, Joel. We're recording tonight because a lot of folks couldn't be here, and we actually have clients throughout the country, and of course they can't be here, but they're interested in the subject matter. So Zach is going to speak into the microphone, and then when we do the Q&A, I'm going to walk around with another microphone so I can grab your questions so that we can put them on the podcast. But my job is to introduce Zach Lamb. Zach is someone who's become a friend over time, and his wife Sherry, who couldn't be with us tonight. And this is Zach's bio. I'm going to read it. Zach's an attorney practicing with Ward and Smith, PA, here in Asheville. Zach focuses his practice on assisting individuals with estate and tax planning and the administration of estates and trusts. He also assists clients with forming, buying, and selling closely held businesses and with tax controversy matters. Zach is certified by the North Carolina State Bar as a specialist in estate planning and fiduciary law. Zach's been practicing in Asheville since 2007. Zach earned his bachelor's degree in economics from Wake Forest University, his law degree from UNC Chapel Hill, his master's in tax law from the University of Florida. While he's not in the office, Zach enjoys cheering for the Carolina Panthers with his wife Sherry, or enjoying the outdoors while backpacking, snow skiing, or playing disc golf. The other thing that you don't know about Zach is he knows how Avengers Endgame ends. He is not going to no spoilers. Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, Zach Lamb.
All right, so good evening. I give several presentations more for continuing education pretty often, and it's to other attorneys. It's usually about, you know, technical tax topics where we're digging deep into statutes or tax code provisions, and it's a pretty right or wrong, black and white, this is what you need to do to avoid getting sued for malpractice or really screwing something up for your client. This is a different sort of talk because this is very individualistic for your children, for your grandchildren, and how you talk to people. And so it was the first time I've been asked to speak on a topic like this, and so I jumped on it. And I'll say I do have a fairly short time relationship with Joel and Bray, but since we first met, I've been impressed with how they've worked with some of our mutual clients, and so I think all of you in the room are with a good group. So before I start any presentation, I'd just like to, kind of my style is to make sure we start with some jokes. And so I've got three financial investment jokes that we'll start with today. One is an oldie but goodie that I've known for a while. The other two I just found this morning, and they really, I appreciated them. So I hope you will too. So the first one. So Jane decided to trim her household budget. And so she decided that she's going to start hand washing her dresses that she would normally take to the dry cleaners. And so after she does that, she goes to her husband and she says, "Honey, you know, I hand washed my dress. I saved us $5. And so he looks at her and says, "Great, wash it a few more times." So that's one. The second one, so a preacher, he goes into his church and he starts to pray, and he asks to God, he said, "How long is 10 million years to you?" And God speaks to him and says, "A second." So the next day, the preacher goes into his church and he asks, "What? How much is $10 million to you?" And God speaks back and says, "A penny." So the next day, the preacher goes into church and he prays and he says, "God, can I have just one of your pennies?" And lo and behold, God responds and says, "Sure, just wait a second." And so for the last one, this one is, did you hear how Mr. Rockefeller made his fortune? So at 18 years old, Rockefeller, he had no money. He was in New York, and he found a dirty apple on the street. And being the entrepreneur that he is, he picked it up, cleaned it off, and found someone to buy it from him for 50 cents. So then he took that 50 cents, and he was able to negotiate and buy two apples for 50 cents. And he took those and went and had people buy them. He had a dollar after that. And he repeated that, bought four more apples, sold it, and had $2. And then he turned 19 and inherited a lot of wealth. So hopefully that, yes, all right. So with that, we can actually get started about the topic this evening. And so this is a fairly challenging topic, and it's on some levels, I was a little surprised they asked me to speak about it. So what is this? This is my family tree. My wife and I have no children, and we have no intention to have children. So I don't have a lot of personal experience to talking about money with my children or grandchildren. But I was a child once. I had parents who had to talk to me, and so I have a lot of the memories of how they brought me and my brother up. And then my brother has three sons, ages 7 to 21, who we like to spoil one at a time and then give back. And so we've tried to help them develop money habits and an understanding of the world over time. So I think I am somewhat qualified. And then professionally, in the 12 years I've been practicing, it's all been focused on generally helping families transition wealth over time. And I usually work with about 100 families a year, or 150 families a year, and I estimate that probably 100 of those are new families each year. So I think I've probably helped about 1,200 families in my 12 years of practice. And what I've learned is every family is a little different. What their goals are, what their values are, what they want to provide for their offspring, and what they don't want to provide for their offspring, it's a little unique. And so I'm going to try to share some of what I've seen work and not work with you as we go through this. So what's the solution to how to talk to your kids and your grandkids about money? Well, it's easy. You give them an allowance of $5 per week at starting at age 8, and you increase by $2 each birthday. You give them a bank account at age 12. When they reach 16, you give them a car, but it needs to be 5 years old, not a new car, and you need to make them pay for gas and half of the insurance cost. When they're ready for college, you pay half of the tuition, but you give them credit if they've gotten scholarships. And then you need to give them 2.3 hugs a day. And of course, this is facetious. There is no right answer, one size fits all, perfect solution for how you talk to your children about money. So thank you for indulging me there. So part of what makes this a difficult topic to talk about is there are a lot of conflicting goals that parents and grandparents have for their offspring. I'll often hear that kind of the most common is they want their children to be self-sufficient. And what that generally means is they want their children to be able to earn at least as much as they spend so that they're at least staying steady. And so, you know, they want more coming in to be able to pay their own bills. I often hear that they want their children to understand the value of a dollar. This doesn't mean they want the child to understand that a dollar is 100 pennies or 4 quarters. When I hear that, what they're saying is they want to make sure that their child understands what it took to make that dollar? What sacrifices went in for that dollar, whether it was, you know, working to earn it, whether it was being resourceful and maybe frugal to save that dollar and earn it over time. But really, this is part of the underlying value there, is that they're wanting to say, someone sacrificed for this dollar, and we don't want you to spend it frivolously. We don't want you to just waste this dollar that somebody worked for. And so the conversation about money is getting them to understand that. At the same time, a common phrase I hear is that, you know, parents want their children to have a better life. And I put that in quotes, but a better life than they had. They may remember struggles that they had when they were growing up. A lot of the people who've generated wealth, they didn't have a whole lot and they had to work hard for it. They struggled, and they want to spare their children that struggle, thinking that if they can spare them, maybe they would start out ahead in life and maybe achieve even more. And sometimes that's the case. There are some people who I know who have been provided, you know, great opportunities because of their parents' wealth, and they've taken that and achieved even more. But oftentimes it's the struggle of having to provide for yourself that gives you the character to go out and achieve on your own. I think of it similar to working out. You know, if you have no pain, you get no gain. And it's kind of that tension that helps you build the muscle. It's balancing those two kind of general thoughts of making them have a better life than you did, but also making them struggle and achieve as they can. And so what I've found is helpful is trying to get you to define, or you know, whoever the parent or grandparent is, to define what your goals are for your children or your grandchildren. What are you wanting them to achieve in life? And then evaluate the behavior that you're doing. If it's paying bills for them, if it's giving them cash, you know, what goals is that behavior supporting, and what goals is perhaps it inhibiting coming to pass, just so you're at least conscious of what you're doing. Tonight, we're going to talk about three general themes. And the first is financial literacy and developing money habits at an early age. Then we'll move on to common missteps that I've seen made by parents and grandparents concerning young people and money. Then we'll finish up with adult children and your wealth. So starting early, researching this, it seems pretty consistent that studies try to say that people develop money habits by age 7. Which most people don't want to start talking to their children about money at age 7. But I guess what this is saying to me is that if you wait until they're in high school to even start talking to them about money habits, you've probably waited too long and they've developed habits that they've seen elsewhere. So it's just recognizing that they're seeing what's going on from you, what's going on in the world, and they're being influenced by lots of different things, and those influences are sticking. Just about all the experts agree that at some age, you need to start giving a young person an allowance so that they can start making their own spending choices rather than just saying, I want this and you buy it for them. It's all over the place on what that age is. I don't know. There is no consensus on what it is, whether it's and what the amount is, which is why kind of the first slide I have was a little facetious with it should be this age and this amount. I found interesting there are two different schools of thought of how you define the allowance to the child. Some behavioral experts say you should define it as, you know, you do these chores and you get this allowance per week or per month or however you want to set it up, which I think is what I've seen more commonly, and it's how my parents raised us, was if you don't do it, you're not getting it. The other school of thought talks about telling your children and teaching it as they get an allowance kind of, you know, so they can meet their needs, but then they have these lists of chores that they need to do, and it's just an expectation of being a member of the family that there is some effort that you need to contribute to be a part of that family unit. And so it's how you define it, and whether you say it's compensation or it's just an allowance for being part of the family. I think they're very subtle differences, but you might want to, I guess, evaluate whether you think what you think would work best for you and your family. I didn't say this, but if you have questions or comments as we go through, feel free to chime in, because we'll kind of bounce all over the place. Although there's kind of a split in the experts about how you define it and how you characterize what the allowance is for, almost all of them agree that you should incentivize them by giving them opportunities to do a little more and get a little more. You know, if I think of this when I was growing up, early age, my father was he was an accountant and had to wear a coat and tie to work and shiny shoes, and so he had the shoe shining set, and so we used to be able to earn an extra quarter per shoe if we shined his shoes at night, and so my brother and I would take turns every week to do that, and so it was something above and beyond we'd normally do. And so I guess trying to think of what those opportunities would be to, so they see that more effort usually ends up to a higher reward. And then everyone agrees that spending choices, so now they've gotten an allowance, that they have money that is their own, and now they have to decide what they do with it. And you can use spending choices as educational moments for your children. An important one is just the physical act of making change. You know, you're probably paying them in cash rather than, I don't know, maybe parents nowadays do Venmo electronic transfers to their children, and there's Amazon buying only. But everyone seems to agree that the physical act of actually making change is an important psychological thing. One, it helps with math skills, but two, it's you know you've just lost that dollar when you've handed it over to someone, and now you physically have less than you did. So if you're buying a piece of candy, if you're buying toys, you can almost hold one in one hand and the one in the other and see what you're trading for the other. Kind of being a student of economics, this was the word I always liked, was, you know, teach them about opportunity cost, which is basically what are they giving up if they're buying something, what can they not buy in the future? So they've noticed they've traded their dollar for something. Now they can't use that dollar to buy something else, and actually have the conversation with them. Don't expect them to just understand that if they buy this bubble gum, they're not going to be able to buy this lollipop. But actually kind of when you're in the aisle with them, it's something that you can, a teachable moment you could have. And these last two are kind of grouped together. It's at some age, and it's probably not really early on, but help them understand what is influencing their impulses. And this is advertising or marketing, and then kind of comparison shopping. You know, when they see their friends have a nice shirt or a nice jacket, is that something that, and think that they want it? Nowadays, media is everywhere. So you have television, and so we're constantly following celebrities who have the nicest and shiniest toys or cars, or social media, or even just their friends who are, it seems like the younger people are living on Facebook or Instagram. And so they're constantly showing what they have. And if their friends are showing it, that's what they're seeing on a daily, if not hourly basis. And so it's very easy to start thinking of comparing their self-worth to someone else just based on, is what they have what that person has. And so trying to have a conversation with them about, is that a good thing? How do they define their self-worth? And really that comparisons like that aren't what life's all about. I know a lot of these are painted in negative lights, but the goal isn't here to say that they shouldn't buy anything, because our economies would crash if no one bought anything. That's why we're here. But it's just to make thoughtful decisions. And so to kind of hopefully instill in them the sense of kind of that pause between impulse and decision to buy. So that's what we're really trying to achieve. Kind of as things move on and progress at an appropriate age, you might introduce them to saving. And this, again, what is that appropriate age? It's all over the map, and it'll just, I won't say you'll know it when it's there, but whenever you feel comfortable that they might understand the decision. At the early age, this one was new to me, using a clear container to save the tangible currency you've given them, kind of as a visual tool so they can see it grow over time. I remember growing up and having a plastic piggy bank, and it was opaque. It actually looked like a pig. But I took joy in feeling that it was getting heavier over time as I was putting change in it. And so I know a lot of the banks nowadays, I've seen their kind of swag giveaways or small clear bank, piggy banks. So I think this is a pretty universal idea that saving and being able to see it grow is very good. I'll say this before we move on. The being able to save the tangible currency, one of the things I found when I was younger, our currency is very beautiful as far as from an artistic standpoint. There's lots that goes into it. So growing up, I really just enjoyed getting down and looking at kind of both sides and really appreciating the artistry that went into it. Even with when you'd see foreign currency that you didn't see a lot back in Catawba County, but it did show up from time to time. And I still wonder, is there that spider in the top of the one right corner of the $1 bill? If you just look at the corner, so there's a lot of webbing there. If you have a dollar, look when you get home. So then when you're saving, you might try to encourage them or incentivize them to save by implementing some program where you offer to match savings. And this is very similar. We all deal with this. If you have a 401k plan and your employer says, hey, I'll match up to 3% of your savings. I'm sure Joel and Bray will tell you if you're not contributing, you're giving up free money. And so at an early age, that's a way you can start teaching children kind of that concept, so hopefully they'll make smart decisions when they're employed on their own. What that is, it's all over the board, whether it's 100% match or like your employer 3%, just whatever you think's meaningful enough to, I guess, influence them. And so on the same lines, you might teach them about interest and kind of the compound returns. So if they're savings, you might try to teach them about interest by saying, we'll give you, and it'll probably have to be more meaningful than your bank is giving you on interest right now, but maybe 10% a month. And so you can pay them 10% each month, and then the next month they'll have their dollar plus 10%, so you're giving them 11 cents. And so that's it's a good way to help educate them about concepts that will help them as they develop their own wealth. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. I like that last idea. When my two sons were young, they had a piggy bank, but when they got their allowance, they put it in the bank of dad, and I tracked it on the computer, and they got 10% added on every month. And I didn't teach real well, I guess, the concept of saving. One kid saved everything. The other kid spent it as fast as he could. And it's still true today about those two boys, but the young men, they're in their 30s now, but it was the bank of dad, but it worked. And I see you bringing that up. It's great. Just wanted to let you know. So.
May we ask what age you started them on that?
Oh, this was at like 9 or 10, 8 or 9, 10, somewhere in there. And one kid walked away at end of high school with like $8,000. The other kid had nothing. He had spent it as quick as he earned it. So anyway, I don't think I taught savings that well to both of them, but.
And so then at some other point in their young life, you're gonna wanna introduce them to sharing and charitable giving if you wanna instill that. And this is, this is where it comes down to the family values. And it's a little about what Joel alluded to with his introduction. And this is where I can't answer the question for you. It is, what does money mean to your family? On some levels, to all of us, money means security. It means we can provide for our basic needs. We can put food on the table. We can put a roof over our head. We can pay for health care. And so for all of us, you can't go through life. Well, it's not easy to go through life and not have any money. I'm always impressed and kind of fascinated by the Buddhist monks who vows lives of poverty. But for most of us, we're not going to live that life. And so then at some level above, once you've had your needs met, then everything else is more of what are your wants? I don't think anyone in this room wants to live at the bare minimum of just getting by. We like having certain things. We like to come to an event like this. I'm not saying that everyone should have just the bare minimum, but then at some point what do you do with the excess? And really this kind of gets down to, how does your family define success? Some people could define success as accumulating the most money. If that's your definition of success, unless you're one person in the world, if you're that one in a billion person who's going to start the next Amazon or next Facebook and have some astronomical amount of wealth, if you're defining your success based on a comparison to someone else's wealth, you're always going to be disappointed in your outcome. You may be higher than some of your peers, but there's always going to be someone else that who's higher. That's a good point. And so then if that is not how you're going to define success, maybe you define success different from money. Maybe it's being a good husband, a good parent, a good grandparent, maybe a good community member, and trying to help others. For some people, it's linked to some religious creed. I grew up as a Protestant, so I'm more familiar with that than anything else. And you know, there's the tithing of 10%. And my parents were very, very conservative churchgoers. And my father taught me it was 10% off the gross, not off the net after taxes. And that's a good way. As young people, it was a way for them to, you know, we would put a quarter in the collection plate as it goes by, or you know, they'd let us actually physically drop it to see what was happening. And so that was a teachable moment. And then a lot of people just choose to make the world a better place of, you know, none of us are getting out of this world alive. You know, that's for sure. And so the question is, what do you want to do with your time and your talents and your treasure while you're here? And some people want to help certain underprivileged people. Other people want to help environments. Other people want to support the religion, you know, this religious group and try to promote it. But it's really what is important to your family and modeling those values for your children and grandchildren so that they can understand it and actually talking to them about it. Letting them understand what's important to you, because if they don't see you on a daily basis, they may not know. I would encourage you to share, and that requires a lot of soul searching on your part. And so then another thing to teach them would be, at an appropriate age, again, appropriate, what credit is. And so this is usually I see people at some big ticket item. You know, they could be, you could be the bank of dad and finance a purchase, not just take savings, but loan out some amount and let them pay you back over time. And if you want to really teach them, you could charge interest on that. So they see that an instant purchase and instant gratification comes with a cost. And as part of that conversation, it's important to let them know what credit cards are, how easy they are to get, and how expensive they can be if you don't pay it off each month, and because it's about the only place where you can get 18% interest rates. So then at some point, you'll have to go, it probably makes sense to go outside the bank of dad and establish an actual bank account with them. They can learn important habits like reviewing their statements to see what entries are there and making sure that their money's not disappearing, or at least they understand what they're spending. You can help them physically make deposits, whether it's go to the bank. Now, if they have their phones, you can deposit a check by taking a picture with a lot of banks. But just to understand kind of the mechanics of a bank. A lot of these things are things they don't teach in schools, and so if they're not learning it from you, it's going to be foreign to them when they walk into one of these establishments. You can teach them to write checks, and it's becoming rarer and rarer that anyone writes a check, but I often hear clients talk, kind of lament that the schools aren't teaching cursive anymore, and so they wonder, how is someone going to sign a check? it is odd. So a lot of what I do is estate planning. We have to sign documents, and I'm waiting for the time when someone comes in and doesn't know how to sign their name. This is an aside, but the other thing they're not really teaching in schools are things like how to address an envelope. I mean, simple things like that. And so if these are things you can, can't you send that via email? But small habits that aren't gone away yet, but they're becoming certainly less common. And it'd be helpful to help them understand, you know, the difference between paying with cash and card. And part of this is just, So credit cards and debit cards were developed to encourage spending. They want to make it less painful for you to think about what you're spending and really incentivize the spending, and you'll get the bill later. Basically, buy now, pay later. And it, psychologically, they've tracked that you don't see, when if you don't have to count out the money to pay for something and you're just writing your name once, for especially larger purchases, you're much more likely to buy. So that's kind of helping them understand that dynamic. And then also just the basic education of what's the difference between a debit card and a credit card. Basically an instant something from your account and a credit card where you're paying it later. Yes, sir.
Now, one of the advantages of a credit card is you have some protections a debit card doesn't give you. A debit card, it's gone in a second.
Credit card, you have the right.
You have the right to appeal, obviously, and you can contest it and possibly not have to pay. So anyway, just wanted to point that out. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll say I personally don't use any debit cards for just that reason, and try to encourage people to, especially with identity fraud being so prevalent, you want them to take your credit card, not your debit card, because you're having to ask the bank for the money back, and their compliance department, and unless you have a really good in with the bank, it's going to take at least a month before they get the money, and what are you doing in the meantime? So it's a good segue into the dangers of identity fraud. And so that's where you'd want to help them understand things like keeping their social security number private, their account numbers, their passwords, although you might ask them to share their passwords with you so you can go online and track their savings. Things like their account statements, probably don't help talk to them about keeping their accounts private from their friends and from other people. So this used to be a conversation that we didn't really have with people, but because it can be so disruptive and because it happens all the time. So on the tax side, it is very common for, if someone gets your social security number, people can file tax returns. And if they get theirs in before you file yours and they're claiming some giant refund, the IRS usually accepts it and just processes it and then looks into it maybe a year later. And so if you send yours in, then it becomes much more complex for you. They give you a PIN number that you have to start entering into everything. And it's just, other than keeping your information private, there's not really a great way to avoid that. And what's harder is the South Carolina Department of Revenue was in the news a couple years ago. They got hacked, and it was several millions of taxpayers in South Carolina. Their information got taken by these hackers. And so, you know, who knows how many years those people are going to have to deal with.
Well, my son, this was, 35 years ago or so, had this incident where a gas company, I think somebody picked his name out of the phone book and charged a propane tank full of gas to him. And so the difference is now we have cell phones, and they would be calling him directly and trying to get his social. Luckily, I was the one called on the home phone and immediately knew something was terribly wrong. Why would he order a giant thing of propane? God knows, maybe he did. But I will, anyway, I stood by him. But they, even when that case was supposedly closed by Suburban Propane, they kept on. They would come back every few years. I still have my file on it because they kept saying, and they would try every time, what's his social? But the thing is, the kids have their own cell phones. So had they been calling him, he might not have had that ability to know, I should not give out my social right away. And I think that's a huge piece for them to understand that. And when we went to school, our socials were posted with our grades, So things have changed in a huge way. So,
Well, no, thanks for sharing. It's certainly a different world out there. And I think most people carried their Social Security cards with them. And now if you lose your wallet, your life could be gone. And that kind of helps flow back into the thinking about identity fraud, since so much is happening online, it's helping them understand and be on the lookout for phishing emails, basically to not just take for granted if they don't get an email that from someone they recognize, not to click on it or start entering into account numbers or social security numbers. Just sadly, you have to make them aware that the world is not always a good place, and there's lots of people out there trying to steal from them. So this was another one of, this is kind of goes along what Joel was saying about the shoe shine box and the bike, is at some point helping them set a budget. And this would be for a larger ticket item, like maybe they want a new toy or a cell phone, it's amazing to me how expensive they can be today. A new car, if they were looking for a vacation at some point. So to help them determine what something's going to cost, and if it's more than they have, kind of figure out how they're going to pay for it. Maybe you ask them to get a job. This not just from the employers of mom and dad, but to actually go out and get maybe a part-time job or a summer job. And there's different schools of thought on this. There's some people are adamant that they want their children or grandchildren while they're in, under college age to be focused on their education because that's going to be more important and they'll earn much more than if they, half put in half effort at education because they're trying to make money to provide some support. Those are usually the people who have a little more and can provide for their children. Other people think that forcing their children to work early builds character, it's kind of that struggle. If they get to very quickly earn that value of a dollar. I'll say my father was in the second school of thought. When we were 14, he made my brother and I start working in the sock factory. We grew up where textile was the big thing, and it was helpful. It made me quickly realize that I didn't want to work for just over minimum wage while punching a clock in a sock factory. So when I turned 16, the first job was similar to making something of my own. A buddy and I started a landscaping business and didn't have to work for any other companies up until we graduated. I'll say the statute of limitations has passed for the IRS to question this. We may not have paid all taxes on those landscaping earnings, those were really fun. After that, my father didn't force, he didn't, there was no requirement that I work while I was in college, that through scholarships and other things, had some needs met. But I worked as a flag football official my freshman year in part-time. My funnest job through life was I served soft serve ice cream at the minor league baseball team, which was the Winston-Salem Warthogs. And I got all the free hot dogs I want, so I didn't get paid much, but I doubled my salary in hot dogs. So it was things like that. I waited tables through law school, and it's those type of things that taught me more than the paycheck I got. It taught me things like customer service and really valuing what you get. So I think getting a job is a good thing, but I do recognize that some people need more time to focus on their studies to make sure that they achieve what they want to from a college standpoint. Which brings us to college. College is very expensive. It wasn't inexpensive when I went through school, but last time I looked, the cost of a year at Wake Forest is double what it was when I went through and around the turn of the century. The earlier you need to have the conversation with them earlier about it, whether they're saving early if you're not going to provide for it, whether they're saving early, you're saving early if you are going to provide for it. But how is that need going to be met if the goal is they're ultimately going to go to college? I'll say I didn't have a lot of help from the public high school that I went to about seeking scholarships and grants. And it's one of those things that you start looking. If you know you're going to look for college, when someone's the freshman year is probably the right time to at least start identifying what scholarships are out there and how you poise yourself to be able to be in a good position to get those. Student loans. These are, it's amazing the people I meet with, especially when it's, I'm meeting with younger families, younger parents who are out of school. They might be a medical professional or even just someone else, and they have young kids, so they're coming to put their estate plan in place. Their largest assets, usually life insurance, because they need it to pay off the student loans if something happens to them. And student loans are very unique in the way the law treats them. It's one of the few things that you can't discharge in bankruptcy. So it could follow someone for life. And I guess I would say think twice before if you're asked to personally guarantee a grandchild's or child's student loan, because if you're not ready to pay for it, then I wouldn't sign that guarantee. Although there's lots of talk. Our state has made some efforts. Western Carolina University now offers a program where tuition's $500 a semester for in-state students. Pembroke University. Yeah. Do you know the other?
Western is one, Pembroke is the other, I don't remember the other two, but they have an arrangement that's been granted by the General Assembly. So that consortium of four, it's $500 per semester. Bernie?
I wanted to add that nowadays, I think it's really important that as parents or grandparents, we encourage kids to understand that college is not an option, that's pretty much like what high school used to be. It's where you're going to go. It's really what people have to do. Now, if they don't go to college, it could be a trade school, but you've got to go beyond high school. That's the point I'm making, that you've got to get a skill. If you don't have a skill, whether it's through college or a trade school or a community college, you're going to be at a significant disadvantage. So I think that's important to instill that with your grandchildren or children, whatever. So,
And I'll share, just piggybacking on that. My wife doesn't have a college degree. We both work outside the home, and she supported me when I was in school, and now she's had to move a couple jobs since we've been here, mainly because one was a landscaping company that in 2009 real estate crashed, so it went under. But she tells me often she has a job. She doesn't have a career, and she doesn't think she'll ever get a career without a degree. And she's a much harder worker than I am, and probably better skilled than I am. But she consistently gets overlooked by people who just have a college degree. And so that's kind of that. If you're looking to kind of climb that higher ladder, it's almost a prerequisite to have something like that. And so I know we're getting closer on time, so I might speed through a couple of these. At some point, you might share some of financial mistakes that you've made, if you've made any, but whether it's something like if you had credit cards, if you had student loans, if you bought a big house and had a mortgage that you couldn't get out of because of the economic downturn or otherwise, if it was just so large it prevented you from saving adequately for retirement. These are things that you can share with them, because it's gonna mean a lot coming from you as opposed to just some hypothetical that I might come up with. So what are some common missteps that I see? The big one is if you give someone, a young person, everything that they're asking for, I counsel trustees who have these trusts that are set up. And so I see some of these families where well-intentioned ancestors transitioned a lot of wealth to people with no education. And those people are really not productive members of society. They oftentimes they're kind of self-destructing, whether it's substance abuse or something else. So it's for you, there's the instant gratification of seeing how they're doing, or knowing that you've made things easier for them, but you might have hurt them in the long run. This one's more of a technical one. I'd say it's probably six times a year I meet with people whose children are about to reach age 18 or 21, depending on how the account was set up. And that young person is about to get a large amount of cash. And what do they do with it? They realize that now that person isn't responsible enough to, they don't want to just turn over $100,000 or some large amount. A UTMA, which is an acronym for Uniform Transfers to Minors Act, It's where you set it up when someone's under age 18. You have a custodian. It's just a statutory trust. So we draft trust agreements that can be tailored however you want them. We can set whatever age you want. We can, you know, make very detailed distribution provisions. To avoid having the complexity of people having to pay an attorney to do this, our legislature has adopted the Uniform Transfers to Minors Act, so people can just use it. But the downside of that is as soon as they reach either 18 or 21, you have to give it to them. There is no way to say no. And so a lot of the strategies we use, if that's coming up and you know people who are in that situation, there are ways to get them to agree when they reach that age to put it into a trust for their benefit where maybe they have restricted control. Again, you can't force them, but you have some leverage by saying, if you don't do this, we might not give you anything else. And so that most people come around to that, or we can use LLCs to restrict their control. But that's one, it surprises me that how often I see that. And so 529 plans are something that's much better. If you're wanting to provide for college, you can put the money in, it grows tax-free, and you can decide when it comes out for educational expenses. And the other one is, I see it more often when I'm talking to people like Bray and Joel. It's people who want to be bank of mom and dad, and they're paying for college. They're paying for, after they're out of college, their rent, their expenses, their credit card bills, their cell phone bills, and they're really not doing anything. The parents or the grandparents aren't saving for their own retirement, and it's really hard to catch up if you've done that. Kind of once your children are old enough and they're kind of adults, it's at that point where it makes sense usually to introduce them to the team that you use. And it could be your CPA to help them learn about tax returns, their filing obligations, gathering information that they're going to need to provide, what tax planning's out there. They're financial advisors, so the Joels and the Brays, and so that's when they can learn a little more in detail about the investment options that are out there, maybe tempering some of the hype. If someone starts talking about Bitcoin or things like that, they can let them know what that really is. Retirement planning, again, this is the compound returns, the sooner the better, and different insurance options. And I guess the question you'll need to ask is, do you introduce them to your advisors and say, let them know everything we have, or do you just introduce them so they can start developing their own habits? And this is kind of the conflicting schools of thought of, are you worried about disrupting their motivation if they see what you have and they think they're going to get it all? Or on the same token, if you're already paying for expensive family trips, or if they think they see a big house and they just assume you're rich and they don't have a number to it, you might actually want to share with them. So there's, again, no right answer, but I guess put some thought to it. Usually at some age, have them meet your attorney so they can talk about it. I would think once anyone reaches age 18, they are legally their own adult. So if they go to college, you don't have any access to their transcript. If you call the college, they're not going to give you your grades. If they go to the doctor, they're not going to talk to you. Our federal HIPAA laws prevent that. So you if they're willing, you can have them sign a power of attorney or a healthcare power of attorney and HIPAA release to let them disclose that information to you. So for younger people, if they're not married and they don't have children, when they die, all their assets are going to come by operation of law. You're their intestate heir if you're the parent. That's not so much the issue. It's more of the incapacity planning or just letting you get information. But then the question is, do you let them know what your estate plan is? They might be assuming that they're getting everything outright and you're saying, no, 30-year-old, I don't think you're responsible enough to handle a large amount. I will say more often than not, people choose not to share their information about their estate plan. Part of it is it's a living document, and hopefully, unless you're terminally ill or we're planning for something soon, you likely will change it at some point in the future. And if you disclosed it, you're setting expectations. And so unless there's a reason, we usually don't disclose it. And so what if you have an adult child with bad habits? And so this is where, rather than giving assets outright, we use trust. And trust can protect against squandering assets. So this is just someone who spends, or substance abuse is a really common one. Or if you're just worried about your child or grandchild's gold-digging girlfriend or spouse, we can protect against that. And we can be very creative in how we do it. We can, I've done a number where we put in drug testing provisions. If you know your child and you just hope that it's going to be better, they get nothing unless they submit to a drug test and it's positive for X months and they have to continue on. Oh yeah, negative, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you, yes. They get nothing if it's positive. And you can also provide incentives. We don't do as many of these, but if you want to say you're not getting anything unless you're out there earning a living, we might match your income. Otherwise, it's going to go to charity at some point. If you want to encourage working for charity, we sometimes provide incentives for that, or for being a homemaker at home. Big question is who is your trustee in this situation? There are corporate trustees that you can use. Just about every bank has one. And there's some that are just trustees. You can use an individual, like a family member or a friend. The big issue I see is I used to think it was an honor to be asked to be a trustee or an executor. It is an obligation. Just seeing yourself in that position is a lot of work. And when I have children or parents who have children, one's responsible and one is not, the question is, who's the trustee for that child? I wouldn't want to be my brother's trustee. And I've told my parents that, because it instantly converts your relationship from one of siblings to one of parent and child. And you are not helping anyone out with doing that. And I've seen lots of sibling relationships destroyed over that. And you're really not saving that much money overall, because by the time, if you name an individual, they're likely going to have to go out and hire an investment advisor, hire an accountant, hire an attorney to understand all this. And that's why banks and corporate trustees exist. They can do that usually for an overall lower price if there's any kind of complexity to it.
One second, Bernie. We got a question or a comment.
I wanted to just ask Zach, what do you think of the concept of if there's two children, co-trustees, so they have to work together as a team, and no one child is a trustee over the other, as you were just talking about. So
I've set up several like that. It usually works if the children are both responsible and both get along. There is some administrative burden to deal with that if people are mobile as much as they are today. So if we need document signs or approvals, we can work with it, but we have to ship documents all around the country. And then we always, if there were just two, we'd need to build in some sort of tiebreaker provision, or essentially you've basically given either one a veto power to stop the trust from doing anything, which may be a good, sometimes we use that as a strategy. You don't want money coming out unless both agree. And so that you can sometimes do it that way. But it also affects investment decisions. So if they need to sell something really quickly and one just refuses to, he can prevent that from being sold. And I'd say the trend now is more often to separate it into two separate shares of trust. And the assets sometimes don't allow that. If it's kind of an operating company, you can't just divide it, because then you don't have majority control anymore. But if it's a brokerage account, we'll often just divide it up and each child can go their separate ways. I just threw this one in here. Marriage is very important. That's a conversation to have early. I think Warren Buffett had a letter that came out recently that said the most important decision you'll make in your life is your spouse, and to choose someone who's better than you are. I agree with that. I think of it like sports. Yeah, you always want to play sports with someone who's better than you to improve. And
Warren's done that twice.
He keeps trading up. Oh, and so I tell people it's like a business. And when you start a business relationship, it's easy to get into. It's difficult to get out of if you haven't laid it out. There are prenups. You can, if you want to, it's a difficult conversation to have on the front end, but a lot of parents and grandparents encourage their children to have prenuptial agreements. If you don't, you know, marriage is going to end in one of two ways, death or divorce. If it's divorce, we here in North Carolina, we have equitable distribution and then alimony rules. So equitable distribution is where the court basically, they classify property as marital property and separate property. And separate property is what you brought into the marriage and gifts or inheritances you received during the marriage. But everything else is marital property, and then the court divides that. So if you give your child or grandchild a large asset and they go and buy a house in their joint name, it's likely now marital property. And if they got divorced, if there's not a premarital agreement, it's getting split.
The question is, what if your kid's assets are in a trust?
When they're married, does that protect
them from this marital stuff? Stuff that's in the trust still?
Yes. So if children don't want to have the prenuptial agreement conversation, then we can, by leaving a gift or an inheritance in a trust, it never becomes titled to them. And so it's not owned by them. It's not part of the marital estate. So the court has no jurisdiction over it to divide it. The income might be taken into account for alimony purposes, but parents can prevent their children's spouses from getting to it. I'll just say, if a marriage ends in death, we have the elective share. So the law lets you disinherit anybody you want except a surviving spouse. So you have no obligation to leave anything to your parents, your children. But if you make a will and leave nothing to your surviving spouse, or don't leave enough to your surviving spouse, based on the length of the marriage, they can file what's called an elective share against your will and ask for up to half of the value that passed at your death. And so those are things that can be waived in a premarital agreement. So for, let's say we don't use a trust and your will just says, I leave it all to my children or my child when I die, and they were married at that time, that's an inheritance. And if they don't put it in their joint names, it's probably separate property, so it won't get divided if there were a divorce. But even if they kept it in their separate name, if they wanted to leave it to the kids and not to their surviving spouse, the spouse could still get at it. It doesn't matter whether it's marital or separate property. So that's where we might use a trust to avoid that result, by having it go into a trust and already say when that child dies, it goes to the child's children rather to the spouse. So I'll stop there.
I have an adult child who probably will be buying a house in the near future. She's unmarried, professional. Should she put the house in her own name, or should and we'll probably be helping her finance it. Should we put it in both our names, or is there any benefit to?
So you could put it in both of your names and maybe even have survivorship rights to it. The risk is, do you want to be at risk for a claim if anything ever arose on the property? So if she's having a gathering and somebody slips and falls off a porch and sues her, and it's above and beyond. I mean, usually we're talking catastrophic injuries, but if it was above and beyond her property insurance, they're going to sue whoever's on the title of the property. So what we
they
more
sue both people.
Yes, okay. you and her. So what we'd commonly do would be, we would have you loan her the money and then secure your loan like a bank with a mortgage on the house. And so when she pays you back, it gets done. But if she has some kind of creditor problem, you have a first priority lien in the house and can at least get back what you paid for it before.
I don't think that's going to be an issue.
Well, we'll just keep, I think we've talked a little about charitable giving already. When people are older and you're talking about adults, a lot of times, kind of like Joel mentioned, this is where you bring them in and let them help choose what charities you're supporting, you know, why you're supporting them, whether you're going to, I think the common catchphrase now is intentional giving. So you're not just writing a check and giving it to them. You're talking to them and helping them, you know, making them commit to where they're going to use those funds over time. And with the changes in the tax laws, what have become very popular are donor advised funds. And these are ways you can give a lot this year and maybe dole it out over a couple years or several years. So you get a deduction 1 year and then you're not itemizing your deductions the next year. And I know Raymond James has a product that they can use for that. So that's probably the most talked about new thing that's happened since the tax law change at the end of 2017. There are things private family foundations. It's rare that I set one of these up any longer, just with the changes in tax laws and expenses. This is basically where you're creating a charity. And you can do things like you administer your own scholarship program. You are administering some kind of charitable thing, or you could just give out grants to other charities. But it is, because of all the hoops, this is more of, it's kind of like $1 million minimum that you're wanting to put into this before it even makes sense. And so when I deal with them, it's usually people who have older ones that are set up and they don't want to get out of, but we wouldn't set them up today. So I just wanted to mention that the tax reporting is very, very easy, or very hard and complex. I really liked these quotes. I came across them. You know, why you don't talk to your children about money, about, you know, if they know how much we have, it'll hinder their ambitions. You know, they'll discuss our finances in the wrong company. My parents never discussed finances with me. They'll worry about our situation. And I didn't make these up. This was from an Oppenheimer Fund marketing thing that Bray had shared with me. But it is powerful. It's very easy to say, I'm just not going to talk to my child or grandchild about money because it's uncomfortable or some of these concerns. But as we talked about, if you're not talking with them, they're getting influence from somewhere else. And at least you have their best interest at heart. And so we'll end this with the quote by Andrew Carnegie, the shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. And kind of what this is talking about is, you know, Andrew Carnegie, I had to do a little research to know his bio before to tie this in. But he was the late 1800s. He came to America with an immigrant family with very little. He worked his way up and then ultimately through some good investments in railroads. And he became a steel baron and owned what became U.S. Steel. He died in the 1890s with in the range of $340 million, which is about close to $15 billion in today's dollars.
10% of
U.S. GDP. Enormous amount of money. And what he did with it, rather, he was married and had a few children, and he left them a respectable stipend, but donated the vast majority of his wealth to charity. And he was afraid that if he left it to his children, that they would squander it, that it would cause them not to want to achieve in life. They've interviewed recently four generations later, some of his descendants, and they're all professionals and kind of well off in their own right. And they probably had a start, but they are all grateful that he didn't leave it to them, that kind of they feel proud of their own achievements because of what they've achieved, rather than just always being known for inheriting wealth and never generating it on their own. And in contrast, his brother, who died around the same time, left trust of it was $10 million or more each to a wife and 9 children. And by now, all of that wealth has basically gone. They've squandered all of that. And so it's a stark contrast of two different families who set up things differently. So I'm not here to say give all your money to charity, but that's an example of why you might want to. So with that, I think we'll open it up if there are any lingering questions or anything else.
You're talking about philanthropy of your family values, and it reminded me of a man I worked for in my 20s who liked to have himself envisaged as a Dickensian character. He was very tight, he was stingy, he was Scottish, and he liked everybody to know how stingy he was. But he always disappeared on Wednesday for a couple of hours, and one day he overbooked himself, and he confided in me that he didn't have time to do his Wednesday work, and he asked me to do it. And it was pretty astounding. It was delivering groceries to people when they weren't home. And I went around and we bought groceries, or I bought the groceries and I delivered them. And his son is a good friend of mine. I don't think his son ever knew that about his father, that he gave, it wasn't a lot of money, but it was an awful lot of time. And he researched who needed these resources. And he went and snuck into their houses like a burglar with groceries.
Well, as an attorney, I'm not advising you to break in, enter, but helping people is always a good thing. All right, well, thanks for listening tonight.
I want to thank everybody for coming, and obviously we're all available for any kind of help. I can tell you some of our best conversations have been with children. It's what I do is, if you've got a child that you want to have speak to us, I ask them to act like it's a business meeting. It's not. You dress up like you're going to a business meeting, and we discuss frankly. I remember one little boy, he was in the seventh grade, and he put on his coat and tie. He's now in college and doing quite well, but we discussed his college. And we've done that with a number of young people over the years. We're happy to do it.
So the content was really good on these slides, obviously, so we're going to post it to our website, and when we do so, we'll send you an email letting you know it's there so you can have it. A lot of you are taking notes, which is so cool. Thanks for coming.